Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
And I am David Goldstein. The date is October 18th, 2021. The baseball playoffs are in full swing. Fish has just played some shows, but you're better off than Fish or baseball because you happen to be listening to The Drop.
Right. As we've done every week in October, I have celebrated the continual stepping further into the darkness, the crispness of the leaves, the wind that is howling, the gray skies that are coming back, the fall foliage that has taken over the oasis that is Denver in the middle of the Great Plains of thus United States. We're in a great time of year. It's finally chilly. I'm happy. We have baseball. We have Fish back. It's a time of year where, like, any album that you put on that has a hint of an acoustic guitar just sounds right. We're in late afternoon tea season. We're in soup season. We're in roasting season. We're just in a good time. Basketball is almost back. Hockey is now on national television, so I'm watching hockey again. Things are good, man. I'm happy. It's Monday. I just got back from San Francisco. We'll talk a little bit about that probably in a later episode, but I'm excited for where we're going here with Fish Tour. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing pretty good. I wish it was a bit colder in New York City. It's always cool in the morning and it still gets up to the 70s. Call it climate change. I'm not sure what, but I'm waiting for a constant 60 degree cardigan windswept days. Need some more of those. But I had a pumpkin scone this morning with cranberries. Definitely felt like fall. It was quite delicious. I drank it with coffee and said, yeah, it really is the fall right now. But as of the time of recording, we're recording this on a Thursday. So, God, Fish Fall Tour starts tomorrow. And between Fish Summer Tour going right into a very interesting Tab Tour, going right into Fall Tour, I feel a bit spoiled. But yeah, I know you're going to a few of those shows. Living on the East Coast, I can't get out to the West Coast for those shows. But That's fine. You'll have it covered for the both of us.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do a fall tour West Coast run. I've only seen one fish show in the month of October, and it's my favorite month of the year, and so I'm really excited to catch a couple of fish shows here in the month of October, going to a couple of my favorite places, San Francisco and Los Angeles. I absolutely love, and they're great in this time of year, so I'm going to see fish shows in San Francisco, LA, and then prior to the LA show, I'm flying down to Phoenix. Going to see Phoenix and Chula Vista with one of our good buddies, Ben Greenfield. We're doing a little bit of a road trip, which I'm stoked about. And then meeting up with our other good buddy, Josh Carver, in LA for the Forum show, which I'm excited about
as
well.
Shout out Nola Sox.
Shout out Nola Sox and Guy Forge OPT. Really both good dudes. Never met Nola Sox, never met Josh in person. So I'm really excited for the opportunity to hang out for the first time after years and years of talking fish, other music, baseball, politics, what have you, throughout our ongoing Twitter DMs, and just see what will probably be a fairly mediocre fish show. It is the Forum, but it's a Sunday night. Who knows? Maybe it'll be mind-blowing. Maybe the band will show up.
So transition to stuff that makes me think about fall in New York is one of our favorite bands, Garcia Peoples, who had an incredible fall residency back in 2019. It was Garcia Peoples season then. I'm happy to report it's going to be Garcia Peoples season now, because they're actually, towards the end of October, they're starting a month-long residency at a venue in Bushwick, Brooklyn called the Sultan Room. I'm definitely going to try to hit some of those shows. And there's new Garcia Peoples music. They recently put out a suite, three songs off their forthcoming record, Dodging Dues, which comes out in January. Happy to report, the songs are great. I think some of the catchiest stuff that they've released, and the new record is produced by he's here, there, everywhere guitar wonderkin Matt Sweeney, so he kind of really beefs up their production values. So I'm pretty happy with those songs, Brian.
Yeah, we've talked about this in various platforms, both on podcasting as well as just kind of individually. In my realm of the universe, my little neck of the woods, I know that they're not the only band that was impacted in this way, but I don't know of any band that got hit harder by the pandemic than Garcia Peoples. Just like on the rise at the perfect time in late 2019, really playing incredible shows, releasing great music. Seemed like 2020 was going to be a huge year for them. They were going to do their first tour here of the West, and then all of that got taken away when COVID hit. And, you know, they played a few live streaming shows, but it just seemed like they weren't yet at that position where they could ride out a pandemic like a few other young bands. And I was really worried that we weren't going to hear too much from them. The fact that they were able to come back, play shows throughout 2021 with everything that was challenging them in their way, play really good shows, and then release this preview here of what stands to be an early favorite of 2022. I'm really excited for this album to be released. I'm excited for them. I loved this EP, and I'm stoked to see where this takes them from a live show standpoint. And also, like, I just hope that this band is able to like reach a point of a little bit more sustainability where they can just do this on a regular basis, because we're all rooting for them here.
Yeah, they've been playing a lot of shows recently. I know they've been playing some shows with their buddies in the trio called Weak Signal. Very good band. And yeah, they're really trying to go for it again. I'm happy to see that they're back in action, because as you know, they're one of our favorite young bands. You want the best for them. I think by the time of our next episode, I think we're taking like a 1 week break, but I think by the time the next episode comes out, there's going to be a new War on Drugs album, which has me quite excited. Obviously, it has Brian excited. We've only heard two songs at this point, but nothing screams fall, falling leaves, campfires, road trips like the War on Drugs. So I think you're going to hear a whole lot about that record in, I guess, forthcoming episodes of The Drop.
Yeah, I can't wait. I've been listening to I Don't Live Here Anymore, the second single, the title track of the record. kind of on repeat. I'm still convinced it's the best War on Drugs song ever written. The riff, the tones, the synthesizers, Lucius, backing vocals on the chorus, like everything about it. The music video, like they look like the fucking E Street Band. I love that Anthony and David Hartley get some backing vocals, like prominent backing vocals in the sub chorus, or I guess you would call it the bridge of the song. That I love the fact that Adam has kind of expanded out and allowed the vocals to go elsewhere beyond his voice. I don't know. I'm just really excited for this record. I think it's going to be a great fall album. I've been listening to a ton of their back catalog and just excited overall.
Read any good books lately?
I'm currently reading a book called A Children's Bible by Lydia Millette that, I tried to read last December and I put down about 50 pages in, and I'm about 100 pages in right now, and I'm trying to power through. It's a really endearing story about, it's like collection of wealthy families that get a summer home in the Cape, and the separation between the parents and the kids. And it's all written from like these teenagers' perspectives, where like none of them know who each other's parents are. And that's like a deliberate choice. They experiment with drugs and alcohol. There's a huge storm that hits where they're at, and the kids end up like leaving because they don't think that the parents are doing a good job of taking care of them. It's kind of like an allegory in a lot of cases for just society and like societal generational breakdowns. There's a lot that I love about it, but there's a lot that I'm kind of trying to like make myself love about it. I don't know. I feel like I need to read a nonfiction book again, but I wanted to read a fiction book at this point in time. Do you ever get to that point where you're like, I need to read a story, and then you read a story and you're like, I just want more information?
Absolutely. I need almost everything I've been reading lately has been nonfiction. A lot of rock bios I've gotten from the library. Also, currently halfway through a nonfiction book being New York Times bestseller, Crying in H Mart. This was the book.
Oh, I need to read that.
Yeah, you would absolutely love it. It's the book, of course, written by Michelle Zauner from Japanese Breakfast. It's a memoir that she wrote about the relationship between her and her mother, who dies of cancer. In particular, it's about the relationship she has with her mother through the lens of food. It's, as much a tribute to, I guess, the glory of Korean food, as well as the relationship between a mother and her daughter, often quite rocky at points. And, you know, I wouldn't exactly call it uplifting, but it's just kind of very fascinating, very extremely well written. Michelle Zauner's capacity to, like, remember things and really put everything into a cohesive narrative is very impressive. I mean, it's no surprise to me that somebody who puts out records as good as the ones from Japanese Breakfast can also be an excellent memoirist. But I think you especially, having spent a significant amount of time in South Korea and Asia in general, would really get into it. I know I had it on hold the library for I think about 7 months, and it finally came up, and I said, oh, all right. Now I have to finish it so I can get it back there as soon as possible for the next person to take it out.
The enduring, just like communal joy of the library. We have a library, a really good library here in town, and I went to it a couple of years ago. It was my first time going to the library, and I don't even know how long. And I just walked in and had like the most basic revelation ever, but like it was also like blew my mind, where I was like, I could literally come in here, get a book for free, read it, consume all the information, bring it back, and somebody else gets to read this book for free. And like that endless cycle is it's a beautiful thing. It's what a service.
And rudimentary, but it's incredible. It's
but
not,
what else works like right. that?
It's unbelievable. The New York Public Library system is one of the most incredible. I can type any author, any book into my phone, and 30 things will come up. Be like, oh, I guess the New York Public Library does have this. Great.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's interesting, you know, because I'm really interested in reading the book. I loved her album that came out this year. It's going to be in probably my top 10, maybe my top 15. It's going to be one of my favorite records of 2021. And talking about Korean food and talking about just like paternal relationship is something that really, really interests me. kind of related. I watched a movie last night that was recommended by a good friend of the pod, Ryan Nichols. It was on Criterion Channel, and I recommend all of our listeners check this out. I'm going to butcher the director's name, so I apologize in advance, but I believe it's pronounced Jaya Zhangke. Apologies if I mispronounce that, but he's a Chinese director from, I believe they consider him the sixth generation of Chinese directors. He was born in 1970, started making movies in the 90s, and most of his movies concern China's shift from the 1990s to today with modernity, capitalism coming into the country, material goods and material wants. And I watched his movie that came out in 2015 called Mountains May Depart, and it was one of those things. I turned it on while I was in the middle of editing an Undermine episode, and I kind of figured I'd have it on the background. And then I stopped editing because I was just completely sucked into the movie. It tells the story of this woman, Tao, through three different parts of her life, a courtship between two men, her increasingly distant relationship with her son following a divorce, and then her later in life, kind of 4 or 5 years into the future, 2025 China, and kind of how she's dealing with the life that she's living in this small town in northern China, and kind of what she's lost, what she's gone through in her life. And it's just like an incredibly heart-wrenching and personal story, but it also like perfectly, without like overtly showcasing how much has changed in China over the last 30 years, like it says so much. And the images that he gets, like he just sits on a landscape and on these like repeated landscapes throughout the film that, like, for someone who's lived in Asia, like I can smell it. I can just like, I watch it and I'm just immediately taken back. So Mountains Made Apart by Jaya Zhangke, that took everything I've been looking for in reading fiction and put it into a film in a way that just like has kind of shook me over the last 12 hours. And I think will continue to kind of digest within me.
I absolutely have to see that. That sounds incredible. Anyway, I think at this point, this is a good idea for us to do just a quick transition to, I know last week on the pod, we didn't talk about a podcast because we had an amazing conversation with Timothy Showalter from the Strand of Oaks, who, if you haven't checked that out yet, what's wrong with you? Check it out. If you're listening to this podcast, you will love that conversation. But this is actually a pretty big week in Osiris Land with something that came out that is kind of a bit of a milestone for our podcast network, would you say?
It is, yeah. The Breaking Waves Seattle podcast. This is hopefully the first of many relationships that we have with Odyssey, covering larger music scenes and larger music eras. I did a little bit of work on this, full disclosure, with Brad Stratton and Kirsten Cluthie here at Osiris. Got to interview some awesome artists and kind of work with kind of behind the scenes as the show kind of took structure over the spring and summer. And it's a 4-part series, tells the history of grunge kind of on a general standpoint, but really has a focus on just what Seattle means as a music city. I'll say, just like from the information I know, like we had so much access to insights into where origins of Seattle music came, which the 1940s, 1950s in Seattle is a fascinating time where a ton of black musicians from the South moved there because it was one of the only places in America where a black musician could join a music union and thus get paid on a regular basis. And that kind of started this swirl of creativity and energy within Seattle. But we focus mainly on the late 80s, 90s. How did grunge build? How did it build in Seattle? How did it explode on the national scene? And then kind of the series will cap off with who are the artists that are utilizing the inspiration of Seattle today? And is there an opportunity for another scene to rise up out of the current structure of the city? So it's a really interesting series. A lot of cool interviews with some artists, some music writers, DJs throughout the Seattle scene going back, you know, 30 years. What were your thoughts on this?
I really enjoyed the first episode because my thinking was, all right, obviously, I'm 42 years old. I was huge into Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, you know, every one of the grunge bands you could name. That was on MTV. That was my bread and butter when I was like 13, 14, 15 years old. I figured, you know, at this point, what else can I possibly know about grunge that I don't? And I was impressed that the first episode, interviews with like DJs, music writers, I think some label heads, also Kim Tile from Soundgarden, Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses, who was in the Seattle punk band The Fastbacks. The episode does a really good job of kind of mining the whole buildup, but I learned stuff. Like there were things that I had either knew or had forgotten about, or some things I did not know at all. I mean, it kind of goes into detail a lot of the Deep Six compilation that kind of kicked everything off. There's a lot of detail on that. There's you know, detail on the British music writer that kind of took grunge back to the UK, and with the UK music mags, they're always looking for the next big thing to sell, like magazines on stand. So I thought that was really cool, and it sounds great, and it's just a really well put together podcast. So I was pleasantly surprised, I'd say.
Yeah, it's I'm just gonna give a huge shout out to Brad Stratton, the lead editor producer of the show, executive producer. It's my first time working with him, and he is a pro's pro. He is incredibly organized, incredibly diligent, and just a total pleasure to work with. And his kind of sound engineering of this show, you immediately feel like you are in the kind of energy and the drive of a scene that is trying to break out, but also a scene that wants to stay pure, wants to stay a part of its origins in a way. And like that constant debate and constant kind of conflict within grunge of like, we don't want to be too big, but also like these are all bands going for broke. It's really fascinating. It also has gotten me to listen to a ton of Pearl Jam live. And I just want to shout out really quickly. I was listening this morning to the Pearl Jam show from Moline, Illinois, 10/17/2014, 7 years ago yesterday, as of this episode coming out, which is just wild, where in the middle of the show, they start playing No Code in full. And, about halfway through the album, you can just hear the audience be like, holy shit, this is actually happening. And when Eddie announces that Stone and Jeff are going to trade guitar and bass for the remainder of the album, it's just like the whole place goes wild. And it's the first time they ever played Moline, Illinois. And it's up on Nugsnet. I think it's on Spotify. I think it's, I think all of their bootleg shows are on Spotify. Maybe I'm wrong there, but it's on Nugs for those of you who subscribe. Fantastic show. I highly recommend it.
Wasn't that the same night the Fish opened their fall tour also?
It was, yeah. Fish played Eugene and played
Cross-Eyed.
One of my favorite Cross-Eyed and Painlesses ever.
That's right. That is the Brian Brinkman Cross-Eyed from the Matthew Knight Arena also on that evening. But I listened to that No Code show. It's really cool. I think No Code is underrated at the time, properly rated now. It was kind of seen as a weirdo Pearl Jam record at the time, but it's aged extremely well.
Yeah.
I love that
record. Yeah. It provides, like, if you listen through their discography, it provides such a great transition from 10 versus Vitalogy into Yield is my favorite Pearl Jam record. I love Binaural. But like that arc of like No Code to Yield, along with them really figuring out how to be a live band that would take these songs with them for the next 25 years, is just such a fascinating second act for them. And No Code really, really provides that transition. So it's a good record to listen to, and it's a good show to listen to in conjunction with Breaking Waves, because one of the larger questions we ask is like, you know, at what point did grunge go from being grunge that we think about to kind of these hangers-on and these kind of leeches of the scene? And it's a good kind of time frame to listen to a show like that.
And there will be a future drop episode when Brian and I kind of do an extended section on grunge and or scrunge songs from 1995, 1996. It's kind of fun and stuff that we talk about all the time, but different podcast for a different day.
Gotta have a machine head for that.
We'll be right back.
All right. So we're kind of trying to figure out what we were going to do in the big discussion here this week. And we were thinking, we've been chatting just the two of us about the current celebration at pitchfork.com about their 25th year. And it'd be a great opportunity to kind of talk about a website that means a lot to the two of us, that has meant a lot to the two of us on an individual and on a, you know, podcasting level since we started talking about music as friends, but also like where we're at and where we've been over the last couple of decades as listeners. And we kind of wanted to run through like how we got introduced to this website, what it's meant to us, what some of our favorite reviews are throughout the years, and kind of who our, you know, favorite writers are and whatnot. Kind of just deep dive into the overall website itself and where we're at 25 years into its existence. So, Dave, I will ask you just kind of out the gates. How did you first discover Pitchfork, and do you recall kind of your first record that you record review that you read of Pitchfork?
So this is funny. God, it all comes back to fish. At some point, this was in 1999, I remember I had a dial-up modem in my off-campus apartment. I don't know if I saw something, it was a fish message board. I saw something about some website that had like a list. The list was like the top 50 worst guitar solos ever. And for some odd reason, it listed Trey Anastasio Demand at like number 2 or number 3. I mean, the randomness of like picking Demand out of all the fish songs you could possibly pick is weird enough. But right. Clicking on that, it led me to a website called Pitchfork that I had never, ever heard before. And sure enough, it was a list written by a guy named Brent DiCrescenzo, who, as it turns out, was probably responsible for about, 25 to 30% of like Pitchfork's early output. And yeah, it was a list of kind of like tongue-in-cheek about bad guitar solos kind of really taking down like the classic rock heroes. There might have been like a Zeppelin thing. And yeah, sure enough, it lists like Fish, Trey Anastasio, Demand, Wankery, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, all right, it's kind of like a jerk thing to say, but you know, it's kind of funny. I think the guy's heart's in the right place. And then clicking further, it was just a wellspring of album reviews, many of which were much shorter than they are now. And they are written by Ryan Schreiber, who was the editor-in-chief. I think another guy named Brent S. Sirota. The earliest thing I remember was that same writer, DiCrescenzo, going crazy over an album by the band Dismemberment Plan being Emergency and I, the classic Dismemberment Plan record from, I think it came out in 1999. Great record. And I think, like, the first line was, like, bottom line, if you like interesting, groundbreaking, awesome pop music, buy this record now. But if you want to hear more about them, you can continue to read the review. So that was one of the earliest things I remember, was this guy who I didn't know telling me, like, if you don't like this Dismemberment Plan record, you're an idiot. And I thought, all right, that's like a pretty forceful way of going about stuff. I sent like the measured Rolling Stone that's just saying, like, here's this record. If you don't like it, fuck you. You'll like it. And I became a very big fan of the Dismemberment Plan after that. Earliest Pitchfork memories are irreverent and forceful. This is what we like. If you don't like it, there's something wrong with you. And as we would continue to see, that approach would only get brattier and stronger as the years went on. But enough about me, Brian. What was your first impressions of that website?
So similarly, it was early college when I first discovered it. I was given a record from a friend, Broken Social Scenes, You Forgot It in People, like 2 weeks into my freshman year of college. And it was kind of this, you know, mind-blowing moment of, okay, this is what it's like being at college, where like there's all these different ideas of music and there's people who spend so many hours like listening to music, and now I'm being exposed to them and know like limitations in terms of like the amount of time I can spend with these people or spend with the music. I have no rules, basically, you know? The grades are the only thing that like define the rules. And as long as those are okay, you can keep doing this thing. And I remember getting that record, listening to it, and being like, how have I never heard of this band? This is one of the best albums I've ever heard in my entire life. Googling them and being led to a Pitchfork review of them. It was the first time I ever read Pitchfork. But I don't recall through that year, my freshman year, really spending a ton of time on Pitchfork. I spent a lot of freshman year building up my Phish collection and exploring classic rock in a way that I never had before. It was like when I got turned on to Dylan, and I went through like my third Beatles phase that like actually made me understand who the band was, aside from just like the movies and whatnot as a kid. But I have a very clear memory of, I returned from Coventry in August of 2014, and about 3 days later, I flew out to Montana, started working, and moved into a house with a bunch of buddies, and I went on to Pitchfork sometime in September of 2004 and read a review for a band I'd never heard of, their debut album, which received a 9.7. And the album began, or the album review began with, how did we get here? Ours is a generation overwhelmed by frustration, unrest, dread, and tragedy. Fear is wholly pervasive in American society, but we manage nonetheless to build our defenses in subtle ways. We scoff at arbitrary color-coded threat levels. We receive our information from comedians and laugh at politicians. Upon the turn of the 21st century, we have come to know our isolation well. Our self-imposed solitude renders us politically and spiritually inert, but rather than take steps to heal our emotional and existential wounds, we have chosen to revel in them. We consume the affected martyrdom of our perpetrated idols and spit back in mocking defiance. We forget that emo was once derived from emotion, and that our buying and selling of personal pain, or the cynical approximation of it, we feel nothing. I read that, and that spoke to 19-year-old me like nothing else had before from a musical standpoint. Do you have any guesses on what that album is, or what that review is, what album that is from?
I don't, actually.
Arcade Fire's Funeral.
All right.
Which, that came out the fall of my sophomore year in college, and was one of the defining records of being in college for me. And that was like a moment where I'd been reading a lot of Rolling Stone at the time, and I finally read Pitchfork and was like, okay, I have to check this website on a regular basis. And for the next few years, I would go to Pitchfork occasionally, but I'd go there specifically for, what am I missing and what do I need to listen to? Where do I need to go from a record store buying standpoint? And that kind of just like broke my brain open. It was like the perfect time for that to happen, and really introduced me to what a music website that was not devoted to and in service of boomer culture could really be. And that was kind of where my relationship with Pitchfork began.
Absolutely. I mean, for the record, that Arcade Fire album slaps, still does slap to this day. You could definitely have another drop episode about my issues with the Arcade Fire in the year of our Lord 2021, but
I think we should.
Yeah, that is a good future content. But yeah, Funeral is classic. Funeral is a classic album.
It holds up, and it speaks to that time period perfectly. And like that review, that was one of the things I loved initially about Pitchfork, was that the reviews seemed to match the albums in such a perfect way, where when you read a good review about a classic album that they were really pushing, you felt like you were reading an extension of the album.
Yeah, an extension of the album. And also you felt that a Pitchfork, if you really like something and then Pitchfork really liked it, you almost felt vindicated. Definitely in the mid-2000s. Yeah. In the mid-2000s, I would say I would put probably the peak of their taste-making abilities at somewhere, I would say, between 2004 and maybe 2009, kind of being the prime blog rock era when writers could become internet famous by putting like MP3s on their blogs and writing about them. You had a lot of like one-hit blog rock wonders, bands at names like Tapes and Tapes that could, you know, Pitchfork could certainly prop up and get them to like at least sell out, you know, like 500 to like 1,200 seat venues based on the strength of a MP3 blog and a good Pitchfork review. It could also, in that point in the 2000s, really take bands down a notch, which is what happened to the frontman of the Dismemberment Plan. Travis Morrison put out a solo record in 2004 after Pitchfork completely loved the two prior Dismemberment Plan records, being Emergency and I and Change in 2001. He put out a solo record in 2004 called Travistan, which, while probably not as good as the two albums that preceded it, the person who wrote that review kind of took it as a personal affront and gave him a famous 0.0, which kind of torpedoed his career a little bit. And I felt bad then, I felt a little bit bad now, but that's, you know, that's kind of, that represents like the peak of when Pitchfork almost had the power of like Rolling Stone in like the early 90s to kind of really torpedo a record.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they also had the ability to just make a band that was kind of eternally loved and revered for any sort of commercial misstep or any sort of like creative misstep, I guess I should say, look eternally uncool. Mm. And I think like one of the best examples is the, I think it was a 5.7 review of My Morning Jacket's Evil Urges, a record I'm not defending in any sort of way, but a record that 2007 My Morning Jacket could do no wrong. They had just released over the course of the previous 7 years At Dawn, It Still Moves, and Z, records that just like kept getting better and showing creative prowess and creative ingenuity of the band. Their live show was incredible. I saw them play right before Pearl Jam at Lollapalooza and they just blew the entire place apart. They still seemed like a band that was out to prove something. And then they release Evil Urges, which is not a record I would defend. I think that there are interesting moments, there are interesting ideas on that record, but I went back and re-listened to it, I think a year ago when the Waterfall Part 2 came out, and it is not very good. Not a defensible record in a lot of cases.
It's not a 4.7.
But that was the thing, was like, I remember when that review came out and, you know, this was a time where like records would leak, but it was also, you had to know the right blogs to find certain records and you had to like have, you know, like a connection almost to hear a record. And so I remember not actively not searching this record out on a leak standpoint because I wanted to buy it. I wanted to get the new My Morning Jacket record. I went to the record store and I bought it. I looked past the fact that like, why are they in fucking 19th century circus outfits? And, you know, maybe this is just like an aside and the records can be great. I listened to the record. I read the review and I immediately was just like, I don't think this band is cool anymore. And it was like the combination of their music plus this review that was so scathing. And those things would happen like on a fairly regular basis, where if you made one sidestep that writers at Pitchfork did not understand, they would just crucify you. And while My Morning Jacket has been incredibly successful and in some cases has rebounded from a creative standpoint, I don't think they've ever gotten back to where they were at in like 2007, where they were appreciated by a growing mass of fans, but also by the critical kind of community.
Yeah, and it sounds kind of ridiculous now in retrospect. In 2021, it sounds crazy what I'm about to say, but in 2007, if Pitchfork gave a record a bad review and you're listening to it, and even if I enjoyed it, I'd be like, what's wrong with me? Is it me, right, or is it them? If Pitchfork really doesn't like it, but I'm into it, it's like, is it my problem? Am I the person? Like, which sounds totally stupid. Like, one man's opinion could have that much of, you know, a feeling on my mindset. I mean, there was a bunch of records like that. I mean, even they were overly critical of, you know, goodness, Wilco's Sky Blue Sky, which, that one certainly immediately comes to mind. But, you know, it was definitely a tastemaker mindset, and they got off in it a bit. And I think they got a bit drunk on the power. But that was before. I mean, now, I guess you could say jumping forward a few years, now they're just one of many. There's still a larger fish, but the pond has gotten significantly wider with the advent of streaming and podcasts, and everyone's got a blog, and there's a ton of websites. Like, it's really, it's gotten diluted, which I think is a good fortunate thing.
I want to ask you before we jump ahead.
Yeah.
Do you have like a particular set of favorite writers for Pitchfork, or like a particularly favorite era of reading Pitchfork where you got just like quality reviews from quality writers?
Let's see. Back in the mid-2000s, I was heavily invested in writing for a Pitchfork competitor. In a way, we house a website called Coke Machine Glow that we kind of, I think, I want to say our peak was probably between, I would say, the website in terms of content and quality of writing probably peaked in about 2008. So I was more focused on that and kind of comparing our writers up against Pitchfork's writers. But in terms of, I don't know if I have so much a favorite era. I think now that I'm older and can kind of appreciate, I mean, I don't think Pitchfork will ever be as special to me as it was when I was in college and discovered it for the first time. Things like Brent D. Crescendo's Kid A review from 2000, you know, the review of things like Wilco's, like, obviously, like Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, you know, stuff from, I don't ever get as excited with Pitchfork from, I would say, 1999 to 2002 when I was still in college, my first year of law school. But now that with the benefit of hindsight, I think I really appreciate it now. Like, I think that the crop of writers they have now in the Condé Nast era is kind of as strong as it's ever been. I think writers like Grayson Haver Curran, our buddy Sam Sadomski is an incredible writer. I mean, I think now, more so than ever with Pitchfork, there's certain writers that if they speak eloquently about something and they like it, then I know that their taste will align with my tastes and I'll enjoy something. But, you know, whereas I wouldn't say so much it gets me excited anymore, but I still check it every day. And the site is still, it had enough of an impact on my life that when I discover a new band or something outside of Pitchfork, one of the first things I'll do is go to Pitchfork and type into the search bar and see if they've been covered in the past and what, like, the writers have thought about them in the past. So it's still always there, but in terms of excitement, nothing so much as when I first discovered it in college.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think that the, it was kind of why I asked was, as we like look back on it now, I feel like there was something to, for me, it was like 2005 to 2010 was when I was reading it. I still check it daily. I mean, the record we're going to talk about that I recommend this week, I found on Pitchfork, and you know, it still serves as this, you know, kind of guiding light for me in a lot of cases. But 2005 to 2010, I mean, I consume and I still go back and read Mark Richardson reviews. I think he was the best writer that website ever produced, and like I loved his perspective, his ability to write in this kind of, you know, conversational tone, but also this kind of authoritarian, you know, this is what this music represents to this time and this place. And he just did a really good job of doing it without seeming bloated in any sort of way. And like, I would hear records completely differently after reading his reviews in a way that I really enjoyed. I mean, I have pulled up here on the screen, Animal Collective's Merriweather Post Pavilion. And I still remember like pulling that up, reading that, in early January, 2009, and just like feeling like we had reached a point in music creativity and music criticism that like spoke to our generation the way that like I'd always heard, you know, people my parents' age talk about Rolling Stone in the 1970s. So, you know, that was for me like LCD Sound System, Sound of Silver, the Grizzly Bear records that came out, Panda Bear's Person Pitch, so many records that were coming out between 2005 and 2010 that were challenging the norms of what indie rock was and what sonically indie rock could be, and having really quality writers like Mark Richardson write about them was for me just like a fascinating learning experience into music at that point in time.
Yeah, I would say Mark Richardson was excellent. A guy named Dominic Leone, also in the mid-2000s, was quite good. What was good about those guys is that they had a level of intelligence and backstory, but it never crossed over into snark. I think a lot of the Pitchfork writers at the height of the mid-2000s, sometimes it crossed over from constructive criticism to just being a dick.
There still is that. I think it's a good transition point to where they are now. I think, you know, the thing that when I still check Pitchfork regularly. I still read the top albums of the year and debate it with friends. I still, you know, I look forward to their end of decade list to get a sense of kind of where were we 10 years ago? Where are we now? What music defined us? I still make lists kind of in the thought of like, you know, when I first started making album of the year list, you know, it was partially inspired by like reading Pitchfork and being, how do I personally define what this year meant to me? And where do I see kind of culture and music at? But where do you see Pitchfork now in 2021? And do you still enjoy it the way that you did? If not, you know, why? If so, why?
I think it's good. I do enjoy it now. Certainly being owned by Condé Nast is kind of taken away some of their autonomy, but it still covers a wide array of records. Like, here's the thing, is that Pitchfork, they're still putting out like 3 record reviews every day, plus like they're mm-hmm. still churning it out. They're still putting out content. They're still writing about the things that interest them that they want to write about. That hasn't gone away. Certainly the array of artists that they cover now are far more diverse than the largely Caucasian indie rock dudes that kind of really dominated the mid-2000s coverage. But whereas it used to be for me one of the only games in town, now it's just one of many games in town. But I still, like you said, I still look at it because often there's certain writers that I like, and if they write about something, I know it's going to be something that I'm going to enjoy. And, you know, they still manage to cast a very wide net. Obviously, it's not verboten to write about mainstream pop as it was in 2005. Like, you know, they would have never covered something, I don't know, like a Beyonce record in 2004 just because that wasn't their steez. And they do so now. But it's in a good place. I think that they kind of got over the hump from, you know, something very snarky, individualistic to something, you know, a little bit more mainstream consumption. But it's, I still enjoy it.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point that, like, if you go back to, say, like 2004, the idea that Pitchfork, like I'm thinking back to that review I was reading from the Arcade Fire. If you think about us generationally compared to our parents and grandparents who were, you know, kind of running the ship in 2004 America and kind of what things looked like then, and obviously we have a wide array of problems right now. But the idea that a snarky, opinionated blog that kind of flipped the middle finger while still, you know, behind the scenes listening to Exile on Main Street at boomers and at like Rolling Stone culture, that would become the authority on music 15 years later is pretty remarkable. And it really showcases a work ethic and an ability to continue mining. I mean, there is not a day that goes by that I don't check Pitchfork and say, I've never heard of that record. I've never heard of that band. And I'll read about them and I'll learn about them there. And that's a pretty huge accomplishment, especially when like you think about Rolling Stone 25, 30 years in, every single U2 album is going to receive 5 stars, no matter what. And so I do appreciate.
I was going to say, I don't know if that would happen now. I don't know if Jan Wenner still is like has the editorial direction that he did in when he gave Mick Jagger's like "Got Us in a Doorway" like 5 stars. But
we'll see what happens when U2 puts out their next record.
Okay,
you know, and I think like there is something to be said about like kind of shooting your heroes. That like they were never easy on a band like Wilco, and Wilco has emerged from a period of kind of being in like this critical no man's land where they could play big shows, but they weren't really celebrated kind of in the way that like we were talking about My Morning Jacket. But I think Wilco in the last 7 years has made some of the best music, if not the best consistent music of their career. And I don't necessarily think that that is like them listening to critics, but I do think it is interesting that like a band like Wilco that was a huge, huge band for Pitchfork in the early 2000s, when Pitchfork needed to have statements on an artist like them, that they have come around and they have, you know, in a sense appreciated where Wilco is at creatively. I think if there's any issue I take with the website in terms of where it's at right now is there does seem to be a decision to almost like cast aside where they were at in the 2000s as though it was like their teenage years and that they have evolved beyond that. And I think if you go back to read a lot of reviews, like I'll do it occasionally if I'm like doing an artist deep dive, there's a lot of really good writing. There's a lot of good writing that admittedly is from a singular perspective in a lot of cases, but it's also people that really put a lot of time and energy and care into listening to records and genuinely, if they loved a record, wanted that band to be successful. And I think, you know, I think of it as like a perfect example right now. I don't want to sound too biased, but like our good friend Tim Showalter, we had on, he put out an album 2 weeks ago as of time of recording, and it's not yet been reviewed on Pitchfork. And he's an artist that has consistently been reviewed on Pitchfork. To me, there is a reader out there that wants to read what Pitchfork thinks of In Heaven. I'm one of those readers. I know you're one of those readers. I know that we have plenty of listeners out there who are like that. To me, to cast aside that, you know, in favor of pop records, you know, records that like I'm pulling up right now, Magdalena Bay, pop record that's got an 8.0. Cool. That's great. But like, why are we not like dipping into, you know, artists that in a sense like got us there still knowing that like there are still readers
right.
out there.
Like for me, I don't really give a shit what Pitchfork thinks about the new Coldplay record.
Right. I don't know. Like that to me is just like clickbait content.
Yeah, exactly. Cause it's going to sell a lot. They're going to sell out every one of their concerts and Chris Martin's going to be perfectly fine and he's going to buy a boat. So I don't really need to see that on Pitchfork. Maybe they feel differently.
They gave it a 5.1. The lead in is here he goes again, looking at the stars, seeing how they shine.
Right,
like, and it starts with a paragraph about like how Yellow impacted Coldplay's career. Did we need to know that?
No.
Did we need like Ryan Dumbal to put, you know, 800 words to that? I'm right there with you. Like, I think there is this weird shift away from rock music that has contributed to rock music kind of falling culturally into the kind of down the stream of where we currently are. And I do think part of that is Pitchfork almost looking at the last 15 years of their legacy and saying, we need to move beyond that. But I don't necessarily know that we do.
No, and they had the recent feature, I guess, was it the 200 artists that have like meant the most over the past 25 years?
Yeah. Is that?
And, you know, we could obviously go through a huge list of who was left off. I mean, for me, the most egregious one that was left off was the artist Jason Molina, just because of the amount of ink spilled on Jason Molina and Pitchfork until his untimely death in 2013. And kind of what he meant to that website in their formative years, what he still means to a huge amount of the readers, and just kind of like to completely, I guess, erase him from the past 25 years with that article versus, I don't know, again, not going to name names, but that was a bit of an oversight.
Well, I think to your point, like, I will name one name because I think that, like, Drake is on this list.
Hmm.
I am not discounting the cultural significance of Drake. I understand. I'm not personally a fan of his music. I don't really listen to him that much. But like, or Pitchfork is still Pitchfork if they never cover a Drake record. I understand that them covering Drake albums like bought them cultural cachet and bought them like, hey, wow, they're going to cover pop albums. But like at the end of the day, the importance of Drake culturally far exceeds anything that Pitchfork is going to have to say about Drake. Whereas to your point, like someone like Jason Molina, if you look back at 2003 Pitchfork writing about the Magnolia Electric Company is a record that both by them helping to break that introduces a wide array of young listeners to one of the best singer-songwriters of the era. And then them continuing to critically analyze him as he went through an incredibly difficult decade that ultimately led to his passing is to me, and I agree with you on this, like is to me a kind of an insight into like where the the site was as a blog to where they are today, to where an artist like that simply couldn't get over the hump. And that to me is like more interesting and more worth analyzing than, you know, one of the biggest pop stars in the entire world who, yes, it was important in the sense that Pitchfork wrote about him, but was it important that they wrote about him versus Kanye West, Jay-Z, Beyonce, you know, a number of other
right.
Hip-hop R&B stars that became global icons that Pitchfork also said, okay, we'll cover these artists as well.
I mean, some of it, I have to be too wary about being too get off my lawn, because when I saw sure. some of the, like an artist, like Lil Peep, who is what he was, I think the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, that was a emo rapper with face tattoos who took a lot of drugs and died young. Like, why should I care about yes. that? Why should Pitchfork care about that? But again, if you happen to be like a teenager discovering Pitchfork for the first time, and obviously they have to be wary of the fact that what the kids listen to now is different than what like a 42-year-old man listens to. So maybe to someone out there, Lil Peep is a significant artist. He definitely wasn't to me, but I don't want to discount the fact that there's readers discovering music and discovering genres and SoundCloud rappers much younger than myself. So Pitchfork has to look out for that as well. So, you know, it's kind of, they're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't.
Yeah, I think the last thing I'll say about it is, like, to your point is, there's an importance in covering certain artists that will potentially introduce new readers to a website that can offer you this endless rabbit hole of both popular music, great criticism, as well as introductions to bands that you might not hear about any other places, all in one place, but to signify certain artists as the most most important artists to the website and to culture of the last 25 years over other artists that like are the reason why you are here, to me seems to be like a slap in the face of where we came from and why the website exists.
Yeah.
To this day, like just in general.
Yeah, I would agree with that to that point. Absolutely.
Well, we've spilled a Brent DiCrescenzo length review ourselves of Pitchfork. So I think it's probably time we transition to the album recommendations segment of the show. All right, supersized episode for you all. Thank you for hanging with us. And we'd love to hear your thoughts if you agree or disagree on kind of what our thoughts are on Pitchfork. We are not the experts by any means. But that said, we are the experts here in Dropland on new albums to recommend to you all, as well as we keep marching back in time. We're going to see how far we can go with this classic album from 1961. Before we get to that, though, Dave, what is your new record that you are going to recommend to the listeners?
So this is an album that is new-ish in the sense that I believe it came out in June of 2021. However, I've only really gotten into it at this point. This is the second album, a self-titled album by a guy named Vincent Neil Emerson, who is a Texas-born and bred singer-songwriter. This is one of the more fully enjoyable, I guess you could say, like traditional country singer-songwriter albums I've heard in some time. It sounds very good because it's produced by, country mainstay Rodney Crowell, who of course has had his own very illustrious solo career as well as producing albums from everyone from Roseanne Cash to Vincent Neil Emerson. So this is a very well-written album. It sounds very good. This is definitely the kind of country record, you know, you almost want to have like a fire pit when you're outside in your backyard, on your back porch, or kind of just like watching autumn leaves fall. I actually kind of got back into this record. I had listened to it when it first came out in June and kind of put it away for a while. Heard the guy recently interviewed on Daniel Donato's excellent Lost Highway podcast. And after hearing him speak, kind of pulled the album back out. And I said, oh yeah, this is quite good and quite nicely epic. So for a very good country singer-songwriter from Texas, Vincent Neil Emerson, let's just listen to the first song on the record entitled Texas Moon. Let's hear it.
Well, I've been stuck in a fiery haze, and I've been feeling this way for days. I got one more night in a hotel room before I'm headed home, following the Texas moon. I've been picking on an old D-20, I've been kicking rocks down the Lost Highway. I've been missing home, but I just can't ever stay. It don't feel like rambling till you take it day by day. Well, I've been worn out.
All right, that is a record I need to dip into. It's kind of the time of year for something like that. So thank you for recommending Vincent Neil Emerson's self-titled album. I'm going to recommend an album. I was talking about this a couple minutes ago just with regards to Pitchfork. I still check it every day. I still see albums from bands I know of as well as albums from bands I don't know of. And some of my favorite things on Pitchfork, like we try to stay on top of, when are these albums coming out? What is our favorite band doing? What are they working on right now? But you can't stay on top of everything, especially when you have a crushing addiction to a band like Phish, where they are in and of themselves, from a live release standpoint, the kind of band that just like continuously puts out new stuff that you have to check in on. So I rely on websites like Pitchfork, Consequence of Sound, Stereo Gum often. And I checked Pitchfork about a week and a half ago. They had a review up for the fifth album from the band Bad Bad Not Good, an album that a good buddy of mine from growing up recommended to me back in 2016. And I've been following them ever since. They're an instrumental group from Toronto. Their fifth album is called Talk Memory, and it's freaking stunning. It's them playing like early 70s kind of psychedelic jazz fusion. It's just a wild record. I don't feel like I need to say too much more about it other than that. Like psychedelic jazz fusion odyssey. Psychedelic jazz fusion odyssey. Are you a listener of The Drop? You will like this record. I sent this to Dave. I sent this to our buddy Josh Carver. And immediately, oh my God, I have to listen to this. The only other thing I will say is this was produced by both Bad Bad Not Good members as well as Floating Points. Floating Points put out a record with Pharoah Sanders back in early part of 2021 that I loved. If you like that record, this is the kind of record for you. So we are going to listen quickly to a snippet off of Talk Meaning, the final track on the album, which features Brandi Younger, an artist that we pushed a few weeks back, Desron Douglas's creative partner on Force Majeure as well. So when you see artists like that playing on albums like this, and once again, psychedelic jazz fusion odyssey within there, you know you're in for a good time. So concluding this week's episode, thanks for hanging with us. This was a ton of fun. Good to kind of do a traditional episode again after our wonderful conversation with Tim. We are going to step back into 1961. And one of the fun things about stepping back into 1961, pull up like the All Music guide on what music was released in 1961. Not a lot of rock records. We're back in kind of a unique interesting part. This is when jazz reigned supreme, which I think that we are both going to highlight here. David, what does 1961 mean to you? And what did you pick?
Well, before I talk about that, if you'll indulge me 1 second, I just want to second your opinion on the Bad, Bad, Not Good record. I know if you hadn't, I figured you were going to talk about that. If you weren't, then I was going to. But that's one of those records that I always say, don't make me have to look for it, which is shoot your shot within like the first minute of a record. And then if that's great, then I'll keep listening. And they don't make you look for it.
No, you're in like 30 seconds
yeah,
in.
Yeah, 30 seconds in, I said, oh, okay, this is my shit. So yeah, that's a phenomenal record.
And that is a good foreshadowing of a future drop episode. Just we'll table that. We'll put a pin in it, as they say in the podcasting world. But that is a good nugget of foreshadowing for a future drop episode.
Yes. Go on. So, but 1961. Okay, a little background. When I was 16 years old, once I was accepted to college, my uncle, who is a part-time, he's a lawyer, but he also plays jazz trumpet quite often, who I love very much, he sent me a box of jazz CDs. He basically said, look, I know that you played trombone in high school, and you're going to play it in college, and I really want to help further your jazz education, and here's some CDs I think that you don't have. So I think one of them was Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. One was J.J. Johnson and Stan Getz at live at the Opera House. And this one, from 1961, being Oliver Nelson's The Blues and the Abstract Truth. And that's become one of my favorite jazz albums of all time. Oliver Nelson's a saxophone player. He's supplemented by Roy Haynes on drums, Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Eric Dolphy on flute, Bill Evans on piano, and Paul Chambers on bass. It is a literal murderer's row of 1960s jazz greats. This is just an elegant record. The first song, Stolen Moments, has become a standard, which you can find transcribed in the Real Book, of course being the public domain book full of jazz charts that jazz musicians have been sight reading to this very day. You put that on, it puts you in the jazz club, you're sitting at the table, you've got a beverage, you're just watching the stage. The second song, Hoedown, much more upbeat and celebratory, it goes into cascades. It's just, you know, there's like nothing for me really to say other than that it's an incredible jazz record, which I own on vinyl, I own on CD, I have it on my Spotify and I want to stream it, and it's just, you know, one of the records I listened to in my formative years and still wows me to this day. Let's listen to Stolen Moments, because that's the song.
All right, so keeping the spirit of things, 1961, the year that Kennedy was inaugurated. Great Hope, we will land a man on the moon in this decade. You know, it's just like anything that you want to point to as like the moment that boomers took over America, it's this. It was also when he invaded Cuba in the infamous Bay of Pigs invasion of April 61, which, man, could you imagine if that happened in the age of Twitter and right-wing news media? Holy shit. I'm going to talk about a jazz record from, I don't know, do we want to call this the greatest saxophonist of all time, John Coltrane?
Top five.
I think probably. Top five. I mean, one of the most incredible musicians I've ever listened to in my entire life. Every time I listen to John Coltrane, I'm just like sent on a journey in the same way that I am with the best artists I listen to.
I mean, Coltrane, there's John Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Oliver Nelson, Pharoah Sanders, you know.
couple options that you could pick from in 1961, Africa Brass, Ole Coltrane, Setting the Pace. I went with Ole Coltrane because it's just a fascinating record that showcases his interest in Spanish music, his interest in the Spanish Civil War, the 1930s, as well as his interest in Pete Seeger and the music of Pete Seeger. This is a modal jazz record. Kind of moves along as the chords modulate and move throughout each song and each movement. It's just a fascinating, fascinating listen. It never like keeps you in one place. There's no tonal center. You're just constantly moving with him in the way that like the best improvisation affects you. And I've listened to this a ton over the last couple of weeks. Just kind of one of those records that it came out in November 61 and it just feels like a late fall record. You know, it's cooler, darker out. Holidays aren't quite here yet. That like warm and fuzzy feeling of the cool season and the impending winter doesn't really exist at this point in time. But what does is kind of this impending darkness and things dying. And it feels like a familiar record for this time. It was also inspired in some cases by Miles Davis's Sketches of Spain, who he used to play with prior to 1961. So really fascinating record. We are going to listen to just a small segment out of the 18-minute title track, Olé. All right. Thanks, everyone, hanging with us. Supersized episode. Why is it supersized? Well, we had a lot to talk about. We hadn't really shot the shit in about 2 weeks, and we are going to be taking a week off. I was hoping we could keep a week-to-week schedule because there's a lot going on here in October, but I'm going to be traveling to the Southwest to see a bunch of fish shows. I'm still slowly creeping towards the finish line of Undermine season 2. As you probably all know, we are taking a brief hiatus while fall tour is going on. We will be back with episodes 7 through 10 in November. Thank you all for listening to that. But I'm hoping to have that finished by the end of this month and just have so much going on. We're going to take a quick break from the Dropland. We'll be back with an episode I am very excited about in 2 weeks' time. So everybody hang tight, listen to the music that we recommended, watch baseball playoffs, listen to Fish Fall Tour. I don't know. There's just a lot going on. What say you, Dave?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can do. The baseball playoffs, eventually go into the Baseball World Series. Basketball is coming back. The NHL has come back. There's fish shows that you can stream on television. There's a whole lot of stuff to do. So if you don't get your drop next week, we're sorry, but you won't miss us too much. And if you do, that's kind of strange. But anyhow, thank you for hanging with us at this point. We are we love doing this. We get a kick out of it. I love chatting with Brian in the morning. It's one of always the highlight of my day when I do so. So we will be back in 2 weeks. We'll hold hands. We'll do some kumbaya. We'll talk some fish. We'll talk some sports. And we will talk about the stuff that you know and love on The Drop.
Hi, this is Henry Kay, host of the number one music history podcast, Rootsland. Come with me on a journey to Kingston, Jamaica, where we explore the world of reggae music and the untold stories of some of the genre's greatest legends. From the ghettos and tenement yards where the music was born, to the island's iconic recording studios. We are so excited to team up with Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. Because as you'll hear, sometimes the story is the best song.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.